Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. You know, I love talking to authors because they have the courage to take their thoughts, their stories, their lessons, and put it down in a book and share it with the many, ultimately changing their legacy and destiny in the process. And if you want to write a book out there, check out dreamstarterspublishing.com. We can help you out with wherever you're at in the process. And if you already have a book, you want to generate leads with it, check out bookmarketingcrm.com. Now, if you're out there and you're growing a business, you will have to get somewhat decent at accounting. Maybe you don't have to be an expert, but knowing what to do, how to set it up, and knowing what the real experts are looking at, therefore, maybe you can have a higher level conversations. And that is why we have our next guest on. She wrote a book on basically how to detect fraud. It's called Using Analytics to Detect Possible Fraud. And this is an expert when it comes to forensic auditing. So I appreciate you coming on, Pamela Mantone. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start off with the genesis of this book, Pamela. What made you want to write this? And, you know, maybe give us a quick little background on where you come from and what got you into this world.
I actually got into forensic accounting by accident, purely by accident, but I found my niche. And I can honestly say that I was one of those people who enjoyed going to work every day. I was impassioned with my work and truly enjoy it. The book was strictly an accident. I was doing a presentation in Dallas when a publisher from Wiley Publications, before I could even get off the podium, came up to me, gave me his card and said, "Would you consider writing about a book about what you just talked about?" And I said, "I'm not a writer. I'm an accountant. You know, this is going to be the most boring book in the world you could ever read." And he says, "But you know your stuff." And so I said, "Let me think about it." And he was pretty persistent. And my late husband told me one day, he says, "I'll support whatever you do, but just remember, not everybody gets this opportunity in their lifetime. You may never get this opportunity again. Are you sure you want to turn it down?" So I didn't. And the reason being I didn't is there's not much knowledge at the time I got started into forensic accounting in college for teaching this, what you need to know, what you need to look at. And I wanted the book in written in plain language so that anyone can read it and understand and use the techniques that's in the book to help them find possible fraud in financial statements or in their business. And it's been very interesting over the way the book has been presented in other areas. I never expected it to go into finance. I expected it to stay in accounting. It's gone into the finance departments. It's gone into the legal departments. And I think that in the college area, and I just think that's been a real surprise to me. But it appears to be very well received in I will say I really enjoy getting emails from those that have read the book, use the techniques, and will email me and say, "I won my case because of Joan's non-discretionary accruals in your book." So then I feel like, yes, I have taught something.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think that what I find fascinating is you have different examples of certain companies in it, and yes. Basically like an allegory, right? You're teaching through whether they're real or fake stories, but people can grasp it that way when how it relates to their business. Yes. Earlier today on the podcast, I had an individual who was an IRS agent for many years, and he was telling me what they look for and how they do things when it comes to civil and criminal investigations. And I'm just fascinated with, you know, how certain people look at books and accounting and what they're looking for. So hopefully you're able to kind of shed some light on it and maybe what to do, what not to do when it comes to doing accounting in your own business. So let's start off with a basic question. What the hell is forensic accounting? Everybody knows what accounting is, but forensic, what do you mean by that?
Forensics is exactly like you would consider forensics and any investigation. I call it a deep dive into the accounting records of a company. And you've got to be able to take those records and apply the research and the support documentation behind those records. One of the benefits of being a forensic accountant, though, is being able to recognize patterns. Embezzlers have patterns. And that's been my primary expertise, has been embezzlement. I've done tons of embezzlement cases. And that's it, finding the patterns, knowing what to look for, finding those patterns. So that's what forensic accounting is. It's kind of a deep dive, and it's not something that everybody wants to do because you're looking at very, very detailed information.
So when you say you are involved in many embezzlement cases, people came to you to kind of create a picture of what's happening financially, right? There's a case, something is going on. Like you said, there's some type of court case. And what does that process look like? Just so people understand your role in everything.
Okay. My role in doing consulting in this, and when I worked for a CPA firm before I retired, and now I semi-retired because attorneys have called me and says, Pam, I need your expertise on this case. Would you be willing to work it? And if it's an interesting case, yeah, I'm going to work it. It's involved two things. Generally, a company suspects something is going wrong. Their sales are great. They've got great business, but their cash flow really stinks. And they don't understand why the cash flow is not what it should be. That's the first clue that you may have something going on in your company that you don't know about, such as possible embezzlement. Then if that's suspected, I work with attorneys. So if a company is suspecting embezzlement and wants me to look into it to see if it's truly going on, the first thing I will do is you contact your attorney. There's a reason for that. I want all my work under the discovery process until the time it has to be provided in discovery. So that gives me the ability to work anonymously and find everything I want to know and basically have my ducks in a row, give it to the attorney. Generally, we're going to make determinations of, okay, do we want to pursue this in a civil court or do we want to pursue this in criminal or do we do both? And I leave that up to the attorneys. The current case that I'm working on now is both. It's in civil court and it's going criminal. And I will be touched on how it starts. And the attorneys work with me and the company works with me. I try to keep it as clandestine as possible. A lot of times an employer is ticked off and wants to fire the employee. And I go, no, give me a back door or a way into your company. And most generally, we'll do back door into computers so that I can look and pull stuff without messing things up in their financial records. But I want that person to feel comfortable with what they're doing. I don't want them to realize that someone is on to them. And they start the good old shredding process. Let's delete all my records onto my computer. And yes, we can get them. It just costs a whole lot more. So that's how it starts. And then we ultimately determine if the case is significant enough to go to court. When I first started working, I was very naive and thought, oh man, I want convictions all down the line. The legal system is not that way. Embezzlement is a white collar crime. So district attorneys and even the company attorneys are not going to take a case to court unless they know they're going to win it. Because, like I said, courts are involved with murder, rape, and the more serious crimes, and white collar is not. So my goal and the work that I've done was to give whoever is handling the case from where I've, my standpoint, their case on a silver platter, so to speak. And I will tell you, I've been very fortunate. Most of my cases were at the federal level, and some were at the state level. So I would work the case completely to the point that I would be turning over everything I have to either an FBI agent or a state equivalent and say, this is what I've got, or a district attorney. And okay. And in most of the time, okay, I'm ready to do interviews. Pam, you want to sit in on the interview? Oh, yes, I want to sit in on the interview. I want to hear what this person has to say. Most of the time I've already interviewed those people, but sometimes it changes a little bit when you have that extra arm of the law in the room with you. But that's basically how these cases go and how they work.
Wow. My assumption is that you're working with big companies, companies that can't keep an eye on everything. And therefore, it's your job, I guess, to kind of make it as easy as possible, put it on that silver platter, like you said, so it shows the breadcrumbs, right? And smaller companies can kind of see what's going on. But even my company, which is really a small business, I will tell you, there's so much going on that it might take 3 or 4 months for me to catch something if there was illegal activity within my organization from somebody using a credit card the wrong way. It might not be right away, right? It might be 4 weeks to 8 weeks, but I can't even imagine these big companies. So am I right to say that you're working with big companies? And I guess my other question is, what have you learned about this? Are you usually where there's smoke, there's fire all the time? Or is there sometimes a very good reason behind certain things?
First of all, I have worked with companies where my embezzlement cases were $250,000. I have worked with companies where the embezzlement cases was over $11 million. Wow. It doesn't matter. In the substantial amount of time that it takes. I'll give you a prime example of one small company case that I worked on, and his typical thing was, he had heard me do a presentation, and I, you know, if there's something wrong, let's take a look, you know, back to the cash flow thing. And we started looking, and I looked at a few things, and I go, some of this is not right. And I started digging. This employee, the office manager, was well respected. Her work was just impeccable. He loved her. She was getting decent salary, bonuses of every quarter of another $3,000 to $5,000. But yet over a period of a year and a half, she had also embezzled over $50,000 that he didn't know. And he thought that was the best employee he ever had. And generally, like I said, the cash flow crunch is the big clue for small companies. But I will tell you, I tell every company, regardless, the perception of detection is your best ammunition against embezzlement. It may take you a week or 2 weeks to look at something. But if an employee knows that you're looking at their work and that you can question, come back and ask questions, and if the business is a little big, okay, rotate what you're looking at. Rotate weeks or whatever, and just don't make a habit of the rotation. You know, just don't say month one, I'm going to do this, month two, I'm going to do that, and keep doing the same thing. Rotate it around. But that's your best bet, because if people think they're going to get caught, they're probably not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I caveat with that, and I always tell businesses, when you come across something and it's, oops, I made a mistake, you have to put in the back of your mind, did that employee truly make a mistake, or were they testing the waters? And if they were testing the waters and they got caught, they're not going to do it again. So that works. Now, in the multi-million dollar, the large companies, embezzlement can take on a multitude of things. The largest one that I've worked on has basically been on collusion, which was more than one employee working together to embezzle money from the company. That's kind of hard to detect sometimes, especially in a large company, but generally there's got to be, and in this particular company, there was an internal control flaw that even their own accounting firm didn't catch. But when I first walked in and looked at the records, that, and this was a Big Four firm, by the way, and I was looking at their internal control walkthroughs and stuff that they did, I saw it right off the bat. And I said, you've done this for 4 years and you've never caught it. There's generally a good reason for that, and that's generally poor training. But that also goes back to the difference between an audit and forensic accounting. Auditors are looking at materiality. A forensic accountant doesn't have materiality. I can look at $1.50. I can look at $5,000. I can look at $1 million. It doesn't matter. And that's the big difference.
Wow. And I would think that whenever it comes to, you know, putting this picture down on paper and putting it all together, it does start to, you start to see motivations and different, I guess, reasons for things to happen. I would assume maybe, like you said, poor training, but not catching it soon enough. And so this podcast is listened by many entrepreneurs. And no. I would think that, I mean, I've talked to many entrepreneurs, hundreds actually, and some of them have said, yeah, I have a really good person, I can't let them go, but they do this, this, and this, and I'm not happy with it. But, you know, sometimes that good that they do outweighs it, and I can't find anybody else. So they kind of like let bad behavior go. And my thought is, yes, that's a huge problem. So what would you say to the entrepreneur listening right now who might have a $1 to $5 million business, other than the fact of, hey, maybe it's really smart to hire a bookkeeper to keep everything in track, and you being on top of it from day one? What would you say to them?
I think hiring a bookkeeper and you review everything that's being done, that's good. If you have more than one employee, it's better. Because if you have that employee that's doing a great job but has a few bad habits, rotate. One of the things that I tell small companies that have less than five employees, okay, you've got a person who does your accounts payable, you have a person who does their accounts receivable. Rotate their jobs. Do cross training. Take this one off the receivable for 1 month or 2 months and reverse it. Make vacations mandatory. Do not let an employee think you're so dedicated that you can't take a day off. Make vacations mandatory.
Wow.
You have to be gone at least a week. Usually, those employees that don't take vacations are generally trying to hide something, and the house of cards are going to come down within a week to 10 days if they're not there to cover it up.
Oh, man, I've never heard that on this podcast. That's a great nugget for anybody listening. Make your staff take mandatory vacations for the mere fact that it allows you to have clarity potentially across all fronts. Oh my God, never heard that. That's awesome.
Thank you. That's one of the first things that I started long ago with small companies when I was doing presentations, because I've had a lot of people ask me, is there always a breakdown in internal controls when you do your embezzlement cases? Yes. How can a small company have internal controls? They can. There has got to be someone overseeing it and looking at it over the shoulder. You want to be in their business. You want to look over their shoulder. That's what it takes. So yes, the internal controls are there. If they're not there, and one of the things that small entrepreneurs and small businesses do is they, over the time as their business grows, they kind of set that aside because they start to trust that person. And that's not what you want to do. You have to keep it professional. I've heard every reason in the world on why I embezzled. And some of them would be extremely shocking. When I first started in my career, the embezzler was one that had a need. And they needed the money. Maybe it was gambling. Maybe it was drugs. Maybe it was this and that. But over the years, my embezzler has changed. The embezzler that I deal with now is the embezzler who thinks he's smarter than anybody else. He's been embezzling money. His boss didn't catch it. His boss's boss didn't catch it. The company didn't catch it. The accounting firm didn't catch it. Nobody can catch it. The case that I'm working on now, the attorney called me and he said, Pam, the suspected embezzlers have stated that even if they did embezzle funds from the company, no one would ever find it. He said, would you take the case? I said, why did you dangle that carrot? Because yes, I'm going to take
it. It's a challenge, of course.
That's a challenge. And that particular case that I'm working on right now has over $10 million embezzled in it. And I have found over $10 million. Hard evidence. That's the one that's going criminal and civil. And the criminal aspects of this one is multifaceted. It's not only embezzlement, which in the state of Tennessee is a Class A felony. It's also got tax implications. We're looking at tax fraud. We're looking at other things that are going along with it. So, yeah, people want to get into that trusting mode just a little bit too much. Mm. And like I said, the embezzler that I deal with now is one who just thinks nobody's going to catch him. And unfortunately, they do jail time. They come out. It isn't going to be long that they're going to be doing it again.
Right, right. I heard the sentences are just not that long for people who do this.
No, no.
And so it makes me think of, I had a tenant a long time ago, 2010. I used to have rental property. And I remember taking a tenant to court. And he was a Eucharistic minister from the church that I went to. And the judge looked at the paper and he goes, you mean this guy's been living in your place? I'm like, yeah, he's up there right now. He goes, he's there right now? I'm like, yeah, he's there. Oh, we've been looking for this guy for years. Yeah. Like, he was known for it. And he just kept doing it and running and running. And it's just, it's up there. Like you said, I like how you brought it up in the beginning. There's a pattern. And it's almost like these people know the game so well, they can't break that pattern. And so yeah. I don't know if there's anything you're able to share with us that you've noticed, but my assumption is, like you said, there's a common theme of playing dumb or maybe using credit cards or doing certain things that kind of hide it in a way that disguise it, that there's no red flags being sent up. So any common themes that might be relevant to our audience?
I'm trying to think because every embezzlement case is generally unique in its own facet. I can tell you some of the things that I have found that might be helpful. One office manager had control of the accounting software. She would run checks make them out to herself. Well, she would do a backup of the software. She would make checks, run it through the software program payable to herself, restore the backup, and then take these checks and record them in the accounting software and used fake vendor names and stuff like that. And yes.
I can see how that could be done. Unless you know the expenditures intimately, it could be pretty easily run through. Am I right?
Yes. This one went on for about 3 years. And one of the ways I caught it is every vendor that a company has, their invoices are going to be assigned a certain number because that's the way they control their customers, which is the vendor. She didn't think of that. So she was using invoice numbers from another vendor for these fake checks and fake invoices. Now, when they were doing the bank reconciliations, the checks coming in were stashed like this high. I mean, you're talking about a 6-inch high canceled check. Nobody ever looked at the canceled checks. They just looked at the bank statement and yeah, it cleared. That's how I was able to pull them, was looking at the vendors and analyzing the vendor invoice numbers. And when I had one of match, I'd go, okay, we need to pull this check. And that's how we found all the checks that she had made for herself. So yeah, it's really easy. Some just blatantly hide it using credit cards. And in larger companies, that's an issue because there's the idea of a larger company where, okay, we got travel and entertainment. Everybody cheats on it. I'm not going to worry about it. Well, okay, I see that. You've got to balance the cost and the effectiveness of an internal control. However, if you let that get away, what's going to prevent an employee from trying something else? So that's kind of the way it is. And my comments have always been to any employer, don't expect me to find all of the embezzlement, because once they find a way to do it, there will be other ways. I learned early on in my career, I want enough, I'm going to give that FBI agent or that DA or that state agent enough money to make a good case. It's not going to be everything they took, because they couldn't afford to pay me for everything that they took. And not only that, you're not going to get the money back. It's gone.
Yeah. That's another aspect of it people don't talk about. Usually you'll never see it again. Am I right?
That's right. Occasionally, if someone is pretty brazen, they're going to, especially if they buy it in property and you can go seize the property. There was one case I worked on where they had a condo, bought a condo in Florida. Yeah. The agent seized that to get some of the money back. But that's not always the case. Most generally, an embezzler is living a very high lifestyle because they want it now. Don't want to work for it. They want it now. So they're going to spend.
They're living above their means. Huge red flag. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Always. And when I would walk into a parking lot of a company, I would look at all the cars down there and I want to know, okay, who's driving the BMW? Who's driving the Jaguar? Who's driving the Corvette? And if it wasn't my top-notch guys, we'd be looking. And one of the ladies, she was dressed to the nines. She's coming in with Gucci bags and all this fancy stuff. And I'm going, boy, she's dressing awfully sharp on her salary. So, I mean, you just have to be very observant. And I guess that's the key. You have to be very observant and kind of know what's going on. And then nobody wants to think the bad things about someone. The psychology of a businessman is very difficult when he finds out his trusted employee has been stealing from him. He's frustrated. He's embarrassed. He knows he's been taken a ride and he feels ashamed, and he doesn't want his colleagues to know that because he feels like he's been stupid. And so you have to get, one of the things that I do is get past that psychological barrier. I want you to get angry at what happened, because when you get angry, you're going to do the right thing. You're going to charge this person. You're going to put out a warrant. You're going to research this. One of the advantages in the book and using those techniques is companies have already lost a lot of money. So you can't have, you have to find ways to find what to look for that's critical. And a lot of the techniques, the analytical techniques in that book is what I use. If I have a company that says, I think I'm being embezzled, the first thing I'm going to do is run those techniques. It's going to tell me where I need to look. Is it truly embezzlement? And if it is, where do I need to go look? What do I need to look at? What areas do I need to focus on? I want to drive that down to a very detailed level and not have to look at everything. That's going to give me what I need for the case to continue to go forward.
And you're talking about using analytics, like you said, within the book to detect possible fraud. So you have what, models in place that show something's off, something's different. And maybe this is based off of historical data, but if you can kind of highlight that, and I'm seeing a couple things here that stand out, whether it's Benford's law and certain things that you reference. Is that what you mean by there's got to be consistency? And the moment you see a little pop up, it's maybe not the answer, but it's something to investigate. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And my favorite one for a small business, and they're looking at their financials, because sometimes small businesses do not make cash flow statements, which is wrong. They need to have a cash flow statement.
I need to do that personally. I'm gonna declare that in the open, because I need to focus on cash flow statements. I'm glad you bring that up.
Yes. And there's a nice little chapter in my book on cash flow statements, because when I teach in colleges and, you know, and they're in the college students are in their intermediate accounting class and they're all about to die from it. And I'll sit there and I'll tell them, you should never have to plug a cash flow statement other than rounding. And they look at me and says, what do you mean? I said, dollars and cents. Cents, yes. Rounding, yes. Nothing else. Why not? The minute you have to plug a cash flow statement, it is telling you that you have non-cash entries on that book. In that book, if you have non-cash entries, and it's not the standard non-cash entry like depreciation, amortization, those sort of things. If it's not that, then you got someone playing with your books. Now, my favorite one, just for when someone wants me to look at something, I have a template from my book on the Banesh M-score model. But my favorite one is Petrescu's F-score. It's simple. It's quick. It's an easy 3 to 5 minutes, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, and I'm done. And it's going to tell me. And if it starts showing me things there, I'm going to go to the Banesh M-score model. That's going to tell me where I need to look. Then I'll use Benford's Law. I love Benford's Law. It's great for a lot of things. Only caveat I'm going to say with Benford's Law is a lot of people will use the first digits test, and I never do that. I use the first two digits, always. And it's going to provide you those outliers, if you will. And that's where you need to go look. And you can get very creative. You have to get creative with a jury when you're testifying. I'll do like a scatter plot, something real simple that can be done in Excel. And here's all these little dots lined up in a row, kind of where they are. And then you've got three or four dots way up here or down here. That's where you go check what those dots represent, because they're outliers.
And most of the people that I know in the small business world are using QuickBooks Online. Are you exporting into an Excel to do this, or can you do it all in QuickBooks?
I export into Excel rather than using QuickBooks. QuickBooks doesn't have that capability. And I like QuickBooks. As I started out when QuickBooks first came into play, and there were some really interesting things with it in the beginning, but now they've really tightened up. I have QuickBooks, but I have desktop. And the only reason I can't do online is because all of my work is generally under a protective order of the court.
Oh, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. So that's why you hear me talk about cases and generalities. Embezzlement cases tend to be that way. And the only way I can talk about them is after they've been convicted. And then I can say, I worked that case. That person got convicted of $4 million and spent 6 years in jail.
And so what you're saying is that these allegories, these stories that you have of company 1, 2, 3, and 4, are they based off of real life that you went through?
All except one.
Wow. Okay.
All except one. And the one that isn't is what I used to tell people in my presentations. I'm an accounting nerd, and I call them post-mortem. In my book, the one case, the governmental case, it had just been exposed. And I went online and I pulled out the financial statements of the government. And I ran every one of those analytical tests in my books on those financial statements just to see if I could find where the problems were. And sure enough, after the book was published, then it came out where those funds went and how they were used. And that book, my formulas had detected every single one of them. And I can say that now. I couldn't say it back then, but that case was Dixon, Illinois, county government, known as the horse lady. And she embezzled a lot of money. That's the only one in my case. When I was writing the book, I've had one regret, and that is I didn't put in a financial institution, and I should have. I want to sit there and let everyone know that these analytics in this book can be for any type of company, whether it's a seasonal, whether it's a full one, whether it's a service industry, whether it's a financial institution, government, manufacturing concern, they all work. All three of the other ones in the book were actual cases.
Wow. Yeah, I'm glad you said that. So this does work for any business. I'm glad you bring up the seasonal businesses, because some people think because it's so sporadic that you can't, but you're right. There's trends to anything. There's cycles to everything. So these laws and models will pick up on it. Is that right?
That is correct. And they will very easily pick up a seasonal trend. And what you want to know is your seasonal trend consistent with your last seasonal trend? I can give a quick example of that. A lot of schools that get scholarship money or donations, and they're restricted donations, which will work in a nonprofit too, restricted donations. Sometimes the restricted donations will come in at the end of the school year and they won't do the expenses to the following year for that donation. So when I would look at schools, I expected that trend. I would have high revenue, restricted revenues 1 year, higher expenses the next year. If anything broke that trend, it was unusual, and we would go research it. So yeah, it works on seasonal trend. It works on any business.
Yeah. And I will tell you, it's only recently that I hired a bookkeeper to manage our books every week rather than once a month or once every quarter. We're starting to really fine tune our numbers. And that's why I'm curious about these, because I'm going to put them through some of these models and laws that you have within this book. All I have to do is export them into Excel and I'll be able to manage this. But it is something that I'm focusing on. That's why this is prime time for us. I'm glad you came on at this moment, because I just hired his bookkeeper in the past couple of weeks. It's great.
Yeah. And for my Excel spreadsheets, all of the formulas are in the book. And the formulas in the book are written as if you were putting them in Excel. That was the only way I could do it. Wiley, my editor at Wiley, she says, why do you have all... I said, I got to do it that way. All those parentheses mean something.
Gotcha. So it's easy to follow along, even if you're not an accounting nerd. Is that right?
That is correct. It's correct. That was the whole focus of the book, was to make it plain language where anyone could understand it. And like I said, you think of some investment companies have contacted me and they use those analytics in that book just on to look at financial statements for a prospective investment they may want to offer. And these investment companies, they're not accounting nerds, but they can go through it. And they've told me, yeah, we've weeded out quite a few because of your analytics. And we've decided that's not going to be part of our prospectus.
Wow. You bring up a good point. I talk to many individuals. Some of them are my clients. They buy businesses. This could be very helpful when you go to buy a business.
Yes, very.
So it's not just internal. It's not just in, starting to focus on whether if there's fraud or not within your organization. It's if I want to buy a company, is there fraud already? That's I never even thought of that until you just said that.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, awesome. So I'm going to take a look at the model, see if I'm able to put that together easily. And guys, check out our books, Using Analytics to Detect Possible Fraud, Tools and Techniques. 4.4 stars on Amazon, resonating with the world. So it's doing really well. Is there a website, Pamela, for them to get in touch with you? I know you say you're retired, so you only do this maybe part-time, but I guess they can get in touch with you on LinkedIn. Is there any other way?
Yes, there's any other way. I'm not sure if my book has my email address, but I'll be glad to share it. It's psmajm1@gmail.com.
Excellent.
And you can probably find it on LinkedIn, because I am on LinkedIn. If you look up fraud and forensics, I do have a very outdated website. I have not kept up with that because of everything else that I do. And like I said, I was kind of semi-retired, but a lot of the attorneys that I've worked with over the years value my expertise at times. So I'm still at it. And I think that says something for how much I still truly enjoy it. Once you've been bitten by the fraud bug, you never go away.
Hey, you're still out there catching bad guys, it sounds like, which is pretty damn exciting, huh?
Yeah, it is. It's nice to know that you're helping a company through a rough stretch. You know, it's not so much of getting the bad guy. Yeah, I want to get the bad guy because, yeah, they've done something wrong. They do not think they've done anything wrong, and they never will. That's just part of the psychology of who they are. But for the business owner, you don't want to see them lose their business because of something like this. So that's always been my goal, to help the business owner and then get the other one off the street.
It's a good way to look at it. Yeah, you're protecting the business. Yeah, obviously, you don't even realize that these embezzlers can really sink a company, right? They could the credit, the basic trust in the company if something were to go very wrong, but also taking enough money out to deplete them completely. Yes. So, wow. Yeah, I never thought about that. So you're there for the entrepreneur, which that's why you're on our podcast, because we love talking about how important it is to think like an entrepreneur and how important business is to those, not just in, within the company, but the ones they serve.
Yeah, exactly.
So Pamela, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. I'm so glad I didn't click off there, because a few minutes passed, I'm like, maybe she's not showing up. Thank God you did. This has been interesting and eye-opening.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And yeah, aside from a little few technical glitches, I was doing my best to get there.
And so if they emailed you, you'll do some consultation, give them some answers, but also, can they hire you? Are you still open for business if they had somebody that they, you know, had a situation? Are you available for work?
It will depend on the case, whether I will take it or not. Like I said, I'm semi-retired. I do limit the work. It's just me. I don't have any staff. And I always feel like at this stage of my game, I need to do it myself, because I'm the one that's going to be standing up, testifying in court and swearing on a Bible. So,
yeah. It makes sense. You're the expert in it. You can't outsource it at this point. Yeah. Yeah. So, hey, that email, not many people give their email on the podcast. I appreciate that. So reach out to Pamela if you have any questions. It's a case-by-case situation if she'll take it, but definitely a person who knows what she's talking about when it comes to forensic accounting. So, Pamela, thanks again. I really appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you. I'm so glad I made it.
Remember, guys, a million-dollar book will lead to a million-dollar life. Right on.